The other aspect of this was the fact that we saw that a significant number of patients, more than half, expect to have nausea, vomiting, and hair loss from the chemotherapy, in spite of whatever they're told, and were surprised when they didn't experience that. How do you explain that?
In our own work, we've also found that patients overestimate the potential for severe toxicity from therapy. And we've surveyed patients and doctors who are considering taking part in phase one studies and found out that patients have a much higher expectation of severe side effects than the doctors who are enrolling them on these studies. However, they discount that potential harm in ultimately making their treatment decision. In terms of why that might be, I can only offer hypotheses. I mean, it may be that as part of the informed consent process, doctors are so cautious about creating unrealistic expectations of good that they go overboard in describing the potentials for harm. And that because informed consent documents, as part of the process, spend a great deal of paper describing potential hazards of therapy and very little describing potential benefits of therapy, this disproportionate attention to side effects may be what fuels patients' perceptions about the harm that might come to them with a particular therapy.
But no, this is on a trial. Normally, when patients are treated in a non-study situation, they don't have informed consent.
Well, they certainly do have informed consent.
Well, written informed consent.
They don't have written informed consent, but really the written informed consent document is in essence the gatekeeper of a process that's gone on over a period of time. And so outside of a clinical trial, it doesn't surprise me that patients also still have a high expectation of harm because their doctor has told them, presumably, of all the terrible things that could possibly happen, such that they don't face the backlash of, you didn't tell me about this, if it were to occur. And also patients might be bracing themselves for the worst to help them feel comfortable with moving forward with this treatment.
So when you have a patient that you're counseling who, for example, is going to receive adjuvant FOLFOX, what do you tell them to expect in terms of GI toxicity and alopecia?
Well, I tell them that there's a potential for severe gastrointestinal toxicity, that this could be severe diarrhea like dysentery, which might require that they get intravenous hydration or that they might need to be hospitalized. I tell all patients that they might die from therapy, although I view that as being very unusual. In terms of alopecia, I do say that that is unlikely to happen, that more typically there could be thinning of the hair, but complete alopecia would be very unusual with a 5-FU oxaliplatin regimen.
Now, we didn't look at this, but a number of patients told us along the way that what happened was that they were told by their oncologist that it'd be unlikely that they'd have hair loss or significant nausea and vomiting, but they heard from family or friends who'd gotten, quote, chemotherapy, that they had this problem. That led them to believe that. Do we know how much that happens in actual clinical practice?
I think it probably happens a lot. And the most common cancers, lung cancer and breast cancer, in addition to colon cancer, those other cancers, the chemotherapy commonly given for those other cancers causes complete alopecia. And so it doesn't surprise me that when querying your friends and family about their experiences or the people that you've known who've gone through chemotherapy, a large proportion of them probably had lung cancer and breast cancer and had complete alopecia. These people also watch television, where your typical cancer patient is portrayed as not having hair.